This episode of Intelligent Medicine is brought to you by Carlson Fish Oils. Fish oil provides the vital omega-3s, EPA and DHA, which support cardiovascular, brain and nerve, vision, immune system, joint, and skin health. Carlson ensures maximum freshness by managing their fish oils from sea to shelf. All Carlson fish oils are tested by an FDA-registered laboratory for freshness, potency, and purity, and they're available in soft gels and liquid form. For more information, go to carlsonlabs.com. Carlson fish oils are available at fine health food stores nationwide. Welcome to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman. I'm very much looking forward to today's conversation because we're going to take up an issue that's of utmost importance, and I don't think we've given this issue enough focus in the past several years, where we've covered virtually every system of the body, from the gastrointestinal system to the brain, the cardiovascular system to the joints. We've looked at autoimmune disease. We've looked at all manner of health conditions, but we haven't paid sufficient attention to the skin. And today we're going to talk to one of America's foremost integrative dermatologists. He's a board-certified dermatologist. These folks are very few and far between, individuals who are trained in conventional dermatology yet have taken an integrative path towards understanding skin issues. He's Dr. Alan Dattner. Dr. Dattner is a longtime colleague of mine here in New York City. He has a couple of offices, one in the city and one in Westchester. He is a fellow of the American Academy of Dermatology, and he has written numerous publications on the subject of skin, both academic publications, and also he's written stuff for popular consumption, and he integrates nutrition and dermatology and holistic medicine into the practice of skin care. So without further ado, here's Dr. Dattner. Dr. Dattner, it's a pleasure having you on Intelligent Medicine.
Well, thank you very much, Ron. It's a pleasure being on this podcast with you.
And I'll continue to refer to you as Alan, because we've been longtime colleagues. I believe the first time that we may have attended a meeting together was, oh my goodness, I have to say, it was in the 1980s, so that takes us back 30-some years. You've been a real pioneer in this field. Perhaps give us a little background into how did you get into this? Because you started out as a conventional dermatologist, and how did you begin to, shall we say, part ways a little bit with your colleagues?
Well, there were two different things that caused me to part ways. First of all, I spent some time in California at the end of the 60s, and of course that was a hotbed of new ideas, and I started hearing about nutrition and curing autoimmune diseases and cancer and all these outlandish claims, but there was appeared to be something behind them, and I was searching for how there could be a truth to that, having a sense that there might be. The other path is that, and I have to say that my integrative interests went way back since I was a boy, from reading my father's hypnosis books when I was in sixth grade, and knowing there was another world out there, getting a hold of early psychosomatic books, and becoming exposed to the thinking that the mind could actually contribute to causing diseases. And the other trend was that I started hanging out in a lab in a little place in Rye called Sloan Kettering with a fellow named Lloyd Old, who was later known as the father of tumor immunology. So I started getting involved with what's known as cellular immunology, delayed hypersensitivity, or basically T lymphocyte responsiveness, way back in the early 60s. And that carried on through into medical school, where I worked with some different people, including Barry Bloom, who was at Einstein. I took off 9 months and worked with him.
I remember Barry Bloom because I trained at Einstein. He was one of my professors.
Yeah, well, Barry and I did some of the first human MIF work. We were trying to separate out T and B lymphocytes before they had that name. We were, we did a number of really interesting things. Unfortunately, I didn't publish those. John David became the MIF guys, but I was working with one of the first leukocyte informational factors way back in 68-69 with Barry. And as you know, Barry went on to become the head of the Harvard School of Public Health for several years. So he was clearly a good horse to ride with.
So you've got a really good academic pedigree in terms of high-tech, cutting-edge, conventional immunology. So you have a real, I guess, profound understanding of how the immune system works. But you chose to take a little bit of a divergent path, tackling problems like allergy and so on.
Exactly. So let me get to the next stage. So two or three more labs later, where I had done other kinds of things with Ari Rubinstein at Einstein, with Mark Hardy there, I then went on to the NIH, to the dermatology branch of the National Cancer Institute, Building 10, where we flew in patients to study them. You know, we had quite a setup in terms of ability to do studies. And we were doing studies on lymphocyte reactivity at that point. And our work moved into lymphocyte recognition and how it recognized various foreign materials like tuberculin and DNCB and whatnot. And we found that there was a requirement not only for the same antigen or material that was the allergen that we were looking at, but also for the histocompatibility type, for the person's own tissue type, and that those two requirements were both required. So we wound up seeing a very complex requirement for both self and the antigen in order to get a secondary immune stimulation or immune attack. We did studies in both. And then I knew that the complexity that we were hearing about from the Baker Street Irregulars in California and from the nutrition people was really likely to be a real phenomena, that different people would respond to different allergens causing the same named disease, like eczema or acne or psoriasis. And then I had scientific proof of that. And so 20 years before this really got into the New England Journal, I had the data to help me understand that this kind of reactivity that was being reported by my friends in the alternative world was a real phenomenon.
So how does that carry over to practical implications for natural healing of skin conditions? In other words, does it mean that different strokes for different folks in terms of allergies and tolerances and so on?
Exactly. That's what it means. In other words, one person could have eczema, and you might pick up the textbook, and the textbook says, well, you know, people with eczema tend to be reactive to wheat and corn and this and that, but we don't know because it's not always the same, and they trail off and don't know what's going on. But with this perspective, we know that some people really could be reacting to corn, whereas others are reacting to wheat or reacting to anchovies or to their staph infection. So there could be many, many different stimuli, and they'll be specific to a given individual at a given time, because exposure and genetics, and now we know immunogenetics, all those things can play a role in creating which sensitivities are setting a person off.
So do you think it's a really a missed opportunity for dermatology? I mean, you know that conventional practice of dermatology is limited to, you know, we rule out cancer, we apply salves and creams, so sometimes we give powerful immunosuppressive agents to patients to deal with conditions like psoriasis, but seldom, if ever, is there a discussion of diet, or is there? Am I missing something? Because I think most of my dermatology colleagues are not urging patients to undertake elimination diets.
I think there's been current and undercurrent of some of that work, but usually it's not consistent, and most dermatologists don't treat entirely with nutritional programs and supplements. They may, you know, bring it up here or there, or if somebody makes an observation that something causes their rash, they say, okay, well, don't eat it, you know, don't touch it.
Right. They say, well, if it bothers you, don't take it, right? But they're not going to do the detective work.
Not usually. And so, in a way, I feel like I'm living, in an alternative world, because I get patients who tell me about stories about things that have gotten better. And to be honest with you, sometimes I'm as surprised as they are. I got an email just last week from a potential patient who said, you know, my brother had vitiligo, and you put him on your program. This is 15 years ago, so it wasn't as sophisticated as what I'm doing now. You put him on your program, and it's almost all gone except for a few spots. So I have a few spots I'd like to come see you. Well, I called her up to make an appointment. I'm shocked because I'd never heard about it.
It's a challenging condition. I agree. And so to achieve success with that is a tall order. Do you care to share protocol you use?
Sure. Well, I'll tell you some of the I haven't had a chance to find the chart because I'm not sure of his name, but apparently he went off to college and, you know, he just figured, okay, made him better. Great. He never let me know.
Yeah. So he assumed that you were a miracle worker. You know, it's like just another day in the office with Dr. Dattner reversing vitiligo. That's a piece of cake. You know, that's why I paid my $300.
Exactly. Well, then it was $240. So, you know, let me go over the basics. Yeah. Basically, I'm doing stuff that we all know about that we nowadays call functional medicine after Jeff. Yeah, Jeff Bland has sort of coined that. But basically, I was fixing his digestion, helping his liver, dealing with yeast overgrowth to help with leaky gut, and taking away things that I heard from his history to be suspicious, either his history or his family's history. So, you know, I'm looking wider and wider for things that could be related in how I'm working him up. I'm using applied kinesiology to choose the best among the various agents in each category that I'm treating him with. I'm looking for things that might be particular aggravators that I need to take away from him. And then once he's doing better, I'm teaching him to, if he has any aggravation of any number of symptoms from gut onto skin or itching, to then put those things in the no category and basically use the improvement he gets to clean the slate so we can see where else the problems are. So it's that kind of approach that I use. And of course, it's more specific according to the different conditions and according to the different individuals, because people come in with all kinds of other problems.
But right, which we'll get into, because there are a variety of problems. But, you know, coming back to your method of detecting what patients should avoid, you know, many doctors use skin tests, patch tests, allergy blood tests. But you mentioned applied kinesiology. Is that your favorite method of determining what to eliminate?
It's become my favorite method because it gives me a point of information that if it corresponds with other points, and I'm doing frenulum diagnosis and tongue diagnosis, I'm putting together a lot of other pieces, so I don't take applied kinesiology as, okay, you know, I picked up this stuff from the floor and it seems to make him stronger, so I'm going to give it to him. I use it to help choose among things that already make sense from the picture that I've gotten.
Mm-hmm.
So it's an additive refinement rather than a final answer. You know, if you test somebody for anti-gliadin and anti-transglutamase antibodies to see if they're gluten sensitive, half of them are going to come back negative who really are gluten sensitive.
Exactly.
So you need pieces of data from their experience. You need other soft data. And if all your flags are blowing in one direction, you know, you say, I think the wind's coming out of the, you know, coming away from that direction, right?
Indeed.
So that's kind of how I use it, not as an absolute individual indicator. And used like that, I find it effective, just as one of my new friends and professors has perfected pulse diagnosis using methodology that you know, was developed over 1,000 years ago in China that was left out. So, you know, there's tremendous room for using things that don't quite fall into the mainstream of public thinking.
Indeed.
I guess that's the best way to put it.
The mainstream also of medical thinking, too. Let's take a look at some common conditions because, you know, we want to provide listeners with news they can use. Let's start with a common affliction. that sends people to the dermatologist, which is acne. And, you know, again, a missed opportunity because kids eat horribly. And it's a teachable moment because, you know, how do you motivate a kid to eat well? Well, you can tell them, you know, you'll live longer. They don't care because they're immortal in their own minds. You won't get cancer. Well, sure. They don't care because that's not, you know, that's not a concern of theirs at the age of 15 or 18. But if you tell them, hey, you know, your skin's going to be radiant and clear up and you won't have zits, hey, that's going to get their attention, right?
Oh, yeah, especially if they've had a lot of social pressure about that, or if they're young women and they want to be attractive. It's a very important thing, and the scarring is quite an issue because that stays with them for most of their life, and the correction is imperfect and expensive. So I treat a lot of acne, and I have been fortunate to have people come back to me and tell me they're really, really better. And sometimes it's people who've already been on Accutane even.
Yep.
And they've failed that.
So terrible drug, gratifying. By the way. A drug that can cause all kinds of side effects. Depression, ulcerative colitis, joint pain. It's nasty.
I've had patients with those things and had to try to detox them from it.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, it's definitely an issue. And it's amazing to see some of these people and how happy they are with things improved. You see, I see acne not just as a disease, but as a symptom. It's okay. Like, you know, you have a red light on your dashboard of your car, and when the it's running out of oil and you're going to burn up your engine, that light turns bright red. Well, you know, if you put black tape on it, you won't see the light. If you, you know, take acne and you take antibiotics, it'll go away. But some of those people are still aggravating the basic mechanisms. So I make two diagnoses. I make the acne diagnosis, the Western diagnosis, and then I make a causal diagnosis. What's causing it? And I think all this is stuff from the gut that shouldn't be getting out into the blood, out into the lymphatics. And so I fix that whole same set of things that I fix with the patient with vitiligo, fixing the gut, the liver, dealing with yeast overgrowth, dealing especially with acne. There are certain foods that are more aggravating, like dairy products, chocolate stimulants, oily foods, sugar. All those things can be, you know, can be
contributory
for the acne.
So, specifically, how do you tackle healing the gut or normalizing the intestinal flora? What are some of the measures that should be undertaken?
Well, I think that, and I go into a lot more detail, by the way, on this in my book, Radiant Skin from the Inside Out, the Holistic Dermatologist's Guide to Healing Your Skin Naturally. And I go into much more detail about the reasoning and how all these things function. But to give it to you in a concise manner, I like to get yeast under control with whatever is appropriate for that individual. And that includes probiotics and anti-yeast supplements and a very strict diet in certain ways. So you really cut back on anything with yeast or mold, and you cut back on sugars.
Mm-hmm.
And cutting back on sugars has multiple effects. The sugar spikes lead to insulin spikes, and that leads to release of something called insulin-like growth factor, and then that pushes a whole other cascade of changes that cause acne. So sugar is aggravating yeast, and it's aggravating the insulin-like growth factor, so
which affects the hormones, and in women can often cause an excess of androgens, which are problematic. But women with PCOS, for example, polycystic ovarian syndrome, they're often pre-diabetic, and the diet change not only helps their blood sugar, it helps their hormones, right?
Yeah, exactly. There are a whole set of mechanisms that Melnick elaborated on that show how all these things are working. It's, you know, multiple different ways. It's, you know, not just one thing like a set of dominoes. It's multiple effects, including the, you know, avidity, responsiveness of androgen receptors gets increased by this. So it's really a whole concert of effects from the sugar and the insulin-like growth factor.
Any favorite supplements really for acne? That, you know, that sometimes people have advocated high-dose vitamin A. Of course, that gets to be like Accutane, which is a vitamin A analog, or zinc, or, you know, are there specific supplements that could be part of a support program.
Well, zinc is an old-time one. You know, it's been around for a long time in the literature. Even during the lean years when I studied dermatology, zinc was touted as being as effective as certain single things like benzoyl peroxide for controlling acne. So that zinc has always been useful. Vitamin A sometimes is still useful for some people, depending upon their degree of follicular plugging. It can be very helpful. All of the supplements that are helping with the yeast control, supplements that are helping enhance digestion, things for leaky gut, all of these things come into play if put in with the right timing.
Mm-hmm. Probiotics, I'm sure, are part of that. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So those are all things that I find helpful for controlling that and for leaky gut. Then sometimes we have to do things if there are hormonal issues, depending upon whether it's androgen related or otherwise. Usually if people have problems with their, around the time of their periods, then we have to look at when the timing is and put in appropriate supplements there. Sometimes, you know, we have to help get stuff out of the body, with various drainage remedies or things of that sort. So
that sounds like it's herbal or homeopathic drainage.
It could be either, depending upon the individual. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there are sort of basic categories of things that you need to address according to which individual. So some people work with me throughout the full thing, and they become much healthier. And by the way, one of the nice things that's gratifying about the work is that, as you probably know from your work, that a certain number of the people who are treated to fix their gut and to get all these things under control stop having bloating and irritable bowel problems.
Sure.
And they start...
instead of side effects, they have ancillary benefits. They have side benefits.
Or benefits, of course. Yeah. And they have, you know, their chronic fatigue leaves, and they can get more done during the day. They can do that extra job, you know, or whatever, or get out at night, whatever it is that they wanted to do. So that's really gratifying to see people get a much better life. The other thing that I think is really important, and I think that this is just not well understood, is that by fixing, in a lot of these women who I'm seeing, remember, are in their 20s and 30s, maybe they're married or maybe they're still, you know, searching, and they are planning at some point to get pregnant.
Mm-hmm.
And to fix leaky gut before somebody gets pregnant, I think, has tremendous benefits in terms of not passing down a series of allergies to their children. Because if you have leaky gut, it gets into the placenta. And I don't know if you know, I've written an article on leaky gut and something related to leaky gut and breastfeeding and eczema. And as a result of writing that article, I have been asked to review a number of scientific publications, and I've gotten a kind of an overall feeling from all this that leaky gut is a growing world issue that is causing the increase in allergy that we're seeing.
Uh-huh.
And so to have the opportunity to work with a young woman who has to put up with, you know, the diet changes, the lifestyle changes, the supplements and all that, but who gets things under control, she's going to change not only their life, but their life of their child and maybe generations beyond that.
Mm-hmm.
Because once you have a leaky gut, you can't treat this during pregnancy, and you can't treat this during breastfeeding.
Mm-hmm.
So the real time to do it is before they get beautiful and get married and get pregnant.
Mm-hmm. It's called prenatal treatment, which is, I think, an important...
Prenatal treatment.
Yeah, it's an important aspect of integrated medicine. Okay, this is a good point at which to pause because we divide our podcast into two parts. Our guest is Alan Dattner. He's an integrative dermatologist. There are very few and far between. He practices here in New York City, where I broadcast from, and also in Westchester, parts north of New York. And he's also author of a book called Radiant Skin, and we'll provide additional details about that. Also ask him about some other common skin conditions, psoriasis, eczema, dry skin, itchy skin. When we return, I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.